All right, so like a number of the speakers, I am back here again for the second time. I was here first 4 or 5 years ago, and so as, in a sense, as someone who's grown up in this community and the free software communities more broadly, it's an honor to be invited back here again and to give the opportunity to talk today. What I wanted to do today is really talk about they have a provocative title, Access Without Empowerment. And what I want to do is really walk through, think of this as sort of like an ideological progress report for the free software movement more broadly. I'm going to sort of talk about how I see free software's mission, like a huge number of other free culture and sort of broader movements for free information, to fall down into a sort of two-part mission. The first being access, sort of promoting access and the dissemination of knowledge and software in particular. And the second is in terms of empowerment, really sort of encouraging people to sort of take control of the software that they're using. What I want to do is suggest in this progress report's part, suggest that in terms of the first mission, in terms of promoting access, we're doing well, very well, and in fact getting better over time. But that in terms of the second mission, in terms of sort of promoting empowerment, we're doing much less well, and that in many ways we're not improving, or at least not improving nearly as well as we are in terms of promoting access. I want to walk through why I think it is we've had these mixed results, sort of to talk through a series of systematic reasons that I've identified in the context of our movements and our advocacy and the way in which we structure and engage more broadly, that we have privileged access and sort of as a result led to victories in terms of access that have not been followed by similar victories in terms of empowerment. And then I want to sort of end by pointing to three sets of strategies that we might be able to adopt to do better in terms of this in the future. All right. So when I give talks like this when I'm sort of talking about free software mission, it's worth going back to the beginning, which is to say the free software definition. And we start out, this is one of these things I've sort of been repeated to me so many times and repeated to other people so many times I can do it in my sleep. But of course, the four freedoms that most of you are going to be familiar with, we start counting at zero because that's really funny if you're a programmer. But of course, the freedom zero is the freedom to use software for any purpose. The second freedom is the freedom to study software, to see the source code, to understand how it works. The second freedom is the freedom to sort of share and redistribute copies more broadly, and then the freedom three, the fourth freedom, is the freedom to collaborate, to share our changes with others, and to benefit as a community more broadly. But as I've suggested, I think that these four freedoms actually come down to two fundamental types of freedom, right? Two categories of freedom more broadly. The first is really about access. And this is a quote from the GNU Manifesto that suggests, and this is Stallman writing, "I consider the golden rule requires that if I like a program, I must share it with other people who like it. Software sellers want to divide the users and conquer them, making each user agree not to share it with others. I refuse to break solidarity with other users in this way." This idea here that if I have something that I like, that I should, that it's sort of the golden rule. It's something we learned in kindergarten, that if someone asks me for a copy, I should be able to say, sure, yeah, I want to share that with you, right? But this form right here, in some ways, is actually kind of like the weak form of the argument. Eben Moglen, who some of you may have run into or had the privilege of hearing speak, gives a much stronger form of this argument that's based on the idea that software, like other information goods, has what he calls, what the economists call zero marginal cost, which is to say that as an information good, it may take a lot of effort or energy to produce it, but that once I've produced that piece of software, the cost of giving a copy of that software to another person is zero, effectively zero. Moglen draws a comparison to a machine that could make food, right? If I could make a machine that could produce and distribute food to a hungry person by pressing a button, Moglen suggests there would be no ethical justification for hunger in a world in which that machine exists, right? It may cost $1 trillion to make that machine, but once that machine exists, starvation is no longer ethically justifiable. Right now, for information goods like software, right, that is the context in which we're in. Once it may, you know, it may take a huge amount of energy and effort that goes into producing software, but once that software exists, everyone anywhere can have it, right? And like all information goods, anyone everywhere can have a piece of software for the same cost that it takes to produce it for one person. And so Moglen suggests that that in this sense, it is an ethical imperative that we be able to share software more broadly. That's the argument that he makes. That's a very strong version of the argument, but there's a weaker form that just suggests that sharing is good, and either one of these leads to this same kind of argument, if not in the same degree. All right. The second type of freedom really comes down to empowerment, right? And empowerment really means not only that people should have access to this stuff, that it should be able to be disseminated widely, but that people should be able to change the software to do what they want. And this is really where I think a lot of the rhetoric around free software kind of gets it wrong, because there's a sense in which software freedom doesn't matter at all. The software doesn't need freedom. The software, you know, wants to, you know, information doesn't want anything. That what matters is the users, the freedom of the users. And it's the people who are using software who matter in this sense. It's about people. I'm talking about this in terms of empowerment, but lots of other terms that people have used to talk about this include things like autonomy or power. And when I try to talk about this, I often give an example using my phone. So if I pick up my, here, I'll show you my phone. If I want to send a message to another person using my phone, I'm going to be constrained in terms of the kind of message that I can send by the technology of my phone, right? If I'm limited to being able to send text messages, I can write a pretty good text message in not so much space, but I'm limited in terms of the nature of the message. If I can call someone to, you know, tell them how great this conference is, I can sing a song, I can send a different kind of message. If my phone can take a picture and I can send that picture and you can receive it, then I can send a different kind of message. The point is that all of these things are, you know, technological decisions that someone made, either in terms of hardware or very frequently in terms of software. And the nature of those decisions constrains very explicitly the kind of message that I can send with this device, right? And to the extent that this device mediates my experience of the world, the question of who controls that device and what it can and can't do is a question of who controls my experience of the world and other people, right? And so insofar as our lives are increasingly mediated by devices like this or like this, the question of who controls those devices or who controls what they can and can't do becomes an increasingly important political question, right? And free software, in this sense, freedoms 0, 2, and 3, or 1, 3, and 4, depending on how geeky we want to be as we're counting them, suggests an answer, right? The answer is you, or users, right? The users of software, insofar as our experience of the world is mediated by these technologies, it is important that users be able to control that technology and determine what it can and can't do. If we look at other movements, if we look at the Wikimedia movement, if we look at Creative Commons, if we look at the open source definition, all of these things, they have lots of different ways in which they describe essential freedoms or core parts of their mission, but all of them come down to these two core types of freedom: freedom to disseminate and sort of spread access, and also and then a freedom or an ability to change and take control, not just be a consumer of sort of information or information goods or software, but also a producer as well. All right. Now, as I suggested, I want to do a little bit of a little progress report in terms of the movement, in terms of these two broad. Missions, or these two broad types of freedoms. Now, in terms of the first, which is to say access, I want to suggest that we're doing quite well, that we've done a fantastic job in our movement of disseminating the stuff that we're writing, the software that we're writing, and that we've been doing good for a long time, and that as time goes on, we're doing better. Now, this is the sort of the classic, people have seen these Netcraft market share surveys or the sort of automatic surveys. These have been published for almost as long as I've been involved in the free software community. And they, for example, show a number of things. The most famous one was the proportion of web servers running different pieces of software. And of course, as long as these statistics have been kept, free software has been dominating. In terms of server-side scripting languages, you see something very similar. That we're now, it's not only the case that Apache is the most widely, serving the vast majority of pages over time, it is now the case that even that number two is also free software. Nginx has surpassed the proprietary alternatives as the second most widely used web servers. Free software is completely dominant in this particular space. If we look, browsers are also largely free, of course, although Internet Explorer once held over 95% of market share after it squeezed Netscape Navigator out illegally, of course, according to antitrust adjudicators in both Europe and the United States. The free software browsers, including Chrome and Firefox and IceWeasel, my favorite, now hold nearly half of the market. Recent industry surveys suggest that over 40% of firms engaged in free software development, engaged in software development at all, contribute to free or open source software projects as part of their work. Free software in this space has been dominant for a long time and is continuing to do, and is in many cases doing even better. If you look at usage shares in terms of operating system, you can look down the list. We are still, as it turns out, waiting for the year of GNU Linux on the desktop any day now, but that in lots of other spaces, including smartphones, including servers and supercomputers and embedded systems, Linux-based operating systems in particular, but free software operating systems more generally, occupy enormous proportions of market share. Lots and lots of people are in lots of different places using free software. You look at the growth curve, one of the first places that free software was adopted in huge amounts was in supercomputing. You can see that there's exponential growth starting in the late 1990s until, of course, we have to slow down because all of it is running free software, right? It's hard to grow past 100% or very close to it. Basically, all supercomputers today use some version of GNU Linux, and you see similar growth in terms of servers. If you look at smartphone share, you can see that Android-based operating systems go from almost nothing in 2009 and are today make up a majority of all smartphones that are being used. You look at embedded systems, including televisions. Your television, if it's a relatively recent one, probably runs some version of the Linux kernel. And an operating system based on free software bits and pieces. Of course, because free software has been so dominant in this, sort of very quickly growing space, you can say we are moving very quickly towards a period of time when there will be more than 2 billion Linux devices in the world, the vast majority of them mobile phones running Android. But if you think about this in terms of the computers that people actually have, we are close to or have recently surpassed a period of time where 50% of all computers in the world are actually running Linux kernels and operating systems which use the software that we as a movement have built, bits of free software here. One problem with measuring the usage of free software more broadly is that it's actually very hard to see when people are using free software in many cases. When I worked at Canonical early on, part of my job was to grow our install base, our base of users and also developers. But in terms of measuring users, people would ask, how many users do we have? And I'd say, I have no idea, lots, as far as we can tell. I was personally coordinated the mailing of millions of different Ubuntu CDs. The CD company that was producing our CDs was so happy with how many CDs we were buying that they made me this framed platinum CD. I gave it to my parents. I'm like, here. They're like, we don't really know what you do, but seems to be going great. Our best measures were often based on things like NTP check-ins, so we could see how many computers were coming online and connecting to us. And even within the first few years of Ubuntu being launched, there were in the orders of tens of millions of users who, by our best measures. And we certainly made millions of CDs which were distributed as well. There are lots and lots of people that are using free software. Here is just a graph from SourceForge. 2009 was the last period of time where I could get good data. But what we can see is that in terms of downloads, what you can see is that there were, you know, the important thing to keep in mind is that there are in the order of 50 million downloads a month during this period. People moved away from SourceForge in large part, but consumption of free software has not abated in other places. There are huge, you know, millions, many tens of millions of people who are, even outside of the stuff that comes installed in their devices, going out of their way to get and download and use free software of various different kinds. We are doing really well in terms of access. There are other places where we can, other sort of similar movements where we can look at access to knowledge in places where measures are a little bit better, because everybody who reads Wikipedia has to go to the Wikipedia website. We have much better data, although still not perfect data, on consumption of pages there. If you, I'll show you this because I'm going to compare it to more measures of empowerment later, but if we look at growth of Wikipedia readers over time, we can see that there are now, if you include mobile, this does not include mobile devices, which is part of why you see it go down there at the end, or mobile views. There are moving towards a billion people who are using Wikipedia each month. So in the broader free culture movement, we are doing very good at producing information, which we are able to disseminate very widely. So, in terms of access, we have been doing excellent for quite a long time. We have been building stuff that lots of people are using and consuming in various ways, and we are, along many metrics, doing better as we go move forward in time. But control and ability to change and reuse is far less universal in the free culture and free software universes by a lot. Here is, over the same period of time, data from on the number of developers in terms of SourceForge. And this is a really, like, I don't know, whatever the opposite of a conservative estimate is. This is the number of people who are sort of developers on a project, and it's double counting everybody. This is assuming that no one on SourceForge has ever joined more than one project, which is not true. I'm participating in many. This is assuming that nobody is inactive on SourceForge, which, of course, if you've participated in any free software community, is also not true. This is like an incredibly generous estimate. And what we see is that the number of active users using this very generous, the number of contributors is in the order of hundreds of thousands. That's to say, a couple hundred downloads per developer every single month. GitHub has somewhere over 9 million users as of the last time that I checked. But of course, this includes lots of proprietary software developers. One challenge with GitHub, which is why I don't have data from them, is getting a sense of the GitHub project's users base, because it's very hard because many projects on GitHub are not distributed from GitHub. So for example, if I write an Android app and I post the source code in GitHub, almost no one will download my Android app from GitHub because you can't run an Android app in its source form. You get it through a store, probably the Google Play Store, and as a result, it's hard to measure that. That said, the rapid growth of free software, as we've seen before, suggests that a majority of these phones are running Android and are installing apps which are available online. And to the extent that the vast majority of people who are running these things like apps on Android are consuming them on Android, we don't really have to speculate about the exact proportion of free software users who are engaged in modifying their software, because a majority of users, which is to say the large majority of users whose only computers are Android devices, can't modify the software that's running on their devices, even if they have access to all of the source code. Because, of course, an Android phone can't modify its own software in and of itself. They're not designed to, for one, in the sense that they don't have affordances or the development tools installed by default, but they're also locked down so that even if you wanted to, you wouldn't be able to do it. You walk into a Google or a company of people writing Android apps, and you see a bunch of people sitting around and using computers. Now, of course, if you were to walk into an office of people writing software to run on laptops, they would also be a bunch of people sitting around using laptop computers, right? But this situation in the past, where the systems we used to develop software were also the systems we used to write software, meant that people could transcend that role in a way that users of devices that are locked down so that they can't run software, and so that are designed so that they can't change software anyway, means that the vast majority of people simply can't. Which brings us to sort of the, this is the last point here, which is that this is the measure of contributorship to Wikipedia, again, since 2007, which is the period of time that there's good viewership information. It shows just the sort of the number of editors over here, and you can see that since 2007, Wikipedia has an editor base, which is decreasing slightly, but is more or less holding constant, and that at its but the key point is the graph over here, which is the percentage of readers who engage in editing the site. So that this is basically that previous graph, the number of readers. This graph right here divided by that graph of the number of readers. And what you can see, of course, is that although the number of contributors to Wikipedia has more or less held constant since 2007 or gone down a little bit, that the proportion of readers has been halved. That we're now looking at that there used to be one in a thousand, let's say, or one in a couple thousand users of Wikipedia would engage in editing or contribution. And today it's half that, maybe one in five or one in 6,000 people ever sort of change anything. That the number, that a smaller portion of people are, proportion of people who are accessing free knowledge are sort of engaging in the freedom they have to change that stuff, to build, to become not just consumers but producers. All right. So, the second thing, that's the update, right? Good in terms of access, in terms of promoting access, less good in terms of promoting empowerment, at least in terms of the way in which our movement has defined it. But I want to talk about why I think this has been this way, to talk about why empowerment is so much harder than access. And I've come up with, I think, five different descriptions or explanations. The first is that access is always sort of step one. That in order to promote, sort of, if our goal is to promote, even if our goal is only to promote empowerment, that we first need to give people access to stuff so that they can then change it. And as a result, our advocacy has, as a broader movement, has focused on promoting access first. This is a picture of an install party. Who here first installed GNU Linux at an install party? Was it me? Was I? No. Who here's run an install party or been to one? A few people, right? I've definitely been to install parties as well. I can't remember if I first installed it that way. Here's a picture of one in Stavropol. I've participated and organized in various ways in a number of these. My local Linux user group in Seattle organizes one every month or two, and people show up to install it that way. We've, in terms of our sort of like the work of our advocacy organizations, it's something that we've made a very important part of the way in which we reach out to people. We have not, for the most part, run similar types of hack on your operating system parties. Not because you couldn't, but I've never not seen that as often. It's certainly going to be pointed to, you know, addressing a smaller group of people. It certainly requires more specialized skills, but it's not something that, generally speaking, we have. I will talk about some examples of people who've done that a little bit later on. In terms of our outreach and advocacy, this is stuff from Software Freedom Day, pictures from Software Freedom Day. Last time I gave some version of this talk, the person who was in that picture was like, that's me, was in the audience. I have stood in, you know, local squares in my cities and handed out CDs to people, CDs running either open CDs, running lots of pieces of free software that could be installed on, you know, proprietary operating systems or installed CDs with free operating systems. As I've suggested, I have sent, you know, helped send millions of CDs to people that were interested in passing those out to people and engaging in promoting the adoption of, the dissemination of free software very explicitly. These are valuable forms of outreach because, of course, using free software is a first step, right? But for the most part, that's where our advocacy, our advocacy has not gone steps beyond just the dissemination of software more broadly in that way. I have participated, as I'm sure a number of you have, in spreading the word or documenting getfirefox.com. This is geticeweasel.com. Iceweasel is the Debian version of Firefox, and it has a very cute logo. And so it's a very funny website because the only way to install IceWeasel is to just apt-get install it on your system. So it's just like a website that tells you to do that. All of these, you know, Get Firefox is about spreading the word of spreading the word about a free software browser that you can install, and it has been enormously effective in terms of spreading the word and increasing access to this free browser in this way. But hackfirefox.com, if it exists, or some version with that, something that is conceptually similar to hackfirefox.com is, if it exists at all, far, far less possible. Now, all three of these, I think, you know, these install parties and outreach events and things like Get Firefox are valuable forms of outreach because using free software is a necessary first step. But we shouldn't stop there, and in each of these cases, that's exactly where I, to the extent that I have engaged in this work, have stopped. We need to focus on advocacy within our communities to ensure that users can take advantage of all of the freedoms, right? The both of these core two types of freedom, all of the four freedoms, and we very rarely do. All right. The second reason why I think that we've really privileged access over empowerment in terms of our advocacy is that there are very often subtle social compromises, sometimes a little bit less subtle. I'm going to sort of retreat a little bit into my sort of day job as an academic studying free software and free culture communities, and I want to touch a little bit on a piece of work that I've done, which uses the Scratch online community. People here use Scratch. You know, Scratch. Scratch is a programming language which is self-written in Smalltalk. It's designed for kids, and it's a sort of graphical block-based programming language, so you sort of can't make a syntactical error. Your program probably won't do what you want the first time, but it will always run. Scratch is also an online community where kids can share the programs that they've used, and every piece of software released on the Scratch website is released under a free license, under the Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike license, so that everyone in Scratch can take someone else's program and sort of build off it. If they can sort of change it, they can use it in different ways. Now, one thing we've looked at in Scratch is when is the sort of the criteria that cause the criteria associated with projects being more sort of generative or popular. And so the trade-off here that I want to talk about is one that I've sort of explored in my research, which is a trade-off between generativity, which is to say the qualities of Scratch projects that make them more likely to be sort of hacked on or sort of remixed. That's the first column here, and there's a series of different things that we measured. One is, for example, how sort of popular or high status the author is within the community. One is how cumulative the project is, which is to say, is it like a remix of a remix of a remix? And then the third will have to do with how complex the project is. But the important thing here is that along all three of these dimensions, we find that the qualities associated with increased generativity, in the sense of the qualities associated with increased engagement and reuse, the kind of empowerment that we're trying to provide, that we're trying to sort of facilitate in the broader free software community, but also in Scratch, are all associated with less original forms of remixing, which is to say that we found that projects are more likely to be remixed if they are moderately complicated, sort of created by prominent users of cumulative, but that each of those things are associated with less original forms of remixing. And the story here is that the kinds of things that a designer could do, right, if you're designing a community or if you're sort of creating a project, that the kinds of things that you can do which will invite engagement are associated, are all associated with sort of, they work by attracting people who are maybe less interested in changing things a lot, or less interested, or less able to change things a lot. That very often there are compromises that we as designers have to engage in that mean that the cost of attracting more people to engagement or empowerment mean that the nature of that engagement is weakened, right? It's a real compromise, which is something which I've been able to show in some of this research. All right. The third kind of compromises, in terms of technological compromises, and these come in a bunch of different ways, and we're very familiar with them already. The most extreme version of this is just in terms of TiVoization, which is to say that freedom is simply compromised in the sense that it is violated completely, and users are simply made unfree. People are familiar with the concept of TiVoization. TiVo released a device which came with free software running on it, but was locked down using essentially DRM, so that users of the TiVo, although they had access to all the code they needed necessary to change the software on their device, couldn't. They didn't have the keys, like literally the keys necessary to install the software on their device so that they could make it do something else. You have access to all the code that you need to change it, and yet you can't. TiVoization is the example of when users have the rights under a license, but no ability in a practical sense to exercise those rights in practice. And that this business model, right, this technique of TiVoization has been very popular more broadly. There's a pile of devices, all of which run, or nearly all of which run Linux in some form and various other pieces of free software, and almost all of which are locked down in a way that that make them unmodifiable, at least without having to sort of attack and compromise your own device. We are succeeding in terms of spreading our stuff by spreading it in devices, not like this or like your television, that make realizing that freedom technologically impossible or at least extremely difficult. Here's another technological compromise, which is a little bit more subtle. People familiar with Wikipedia Zero? Wikipedia Zero is a project launched by the Wikimedia Foundation, which makes access to Wikipedia free for users in large parts of the developing world. They essentially make agreements with telecommunication providers in the developing world to say that when that people want to access Wikipedia from their mobile devices, that they won't be charged for that access, that it's free for them. At no cost. And this is great in the sense that this means that, you know, the world's knowledge is accessible to, you know, as reflected in Wikipedia, is accessible to huge numbers of people around the world. And yet the nature of that access is compromised, because when WikiZero first launched initially, there was no way to edit Wikipedia from a mobile device, right? I mean, this is like a very clear technological compromise. It is now the case that you can edit Wikipedia from a mobile device, but it is much harder, and that many of the features that sort of many of the most active editors on Wikipedia take advantage of to edit Wikipedia effectively are simply not available to users of mobile devices. That we have in our desire to spread access more widely, in the case of I'm also very involved in the Wikimedia community, we have decided to trade off users' ability to engage in production as well. All right. A fourth sort of answer to why comes down to what I call sort of second-order digital divides. And there's a great piece of work by Esther Hargitay and Aaron Shaw, both at Northwestern University, that again looks at the gender gap within Wikipedia. So this is a gender gap in Wikipedia. You may have heard that the vast majority of people who contribute to Wikipedia are male. And this has been seen within that community as a problem. There's a very similar conversation that's been happening in the free software community for a very long time. I can sort of look around the room and get a sense that, you know, there's still work to be done in many ways. Hargitay and Shaw's work has actually suggested that a big portion of the gender gap, at least in the context of Wikipedia, actually comes down to a skills gap. That an important variable that we haven't looked at is the fact that there are many people who have access to a particular information good don't have the skills necessary to do it. And Wikipedia is a kind of a nice example, because contributing to Wikipedia is supposedly much easier than contributing to free and open source software, in the sense that you don't need to know a programming language. You just have to know how to press the edit button and make a change. And yet the technical skill gap means that large numbers of users of Wikipedia, including many of the sort of the other kinds of demographic gaps that the community cares about, are actually keeping these people from being able to participate. The many people don't until we address this inequality in terms of sort of skills, not just having the stuff, but also having the skills necessary to take advantage of it, which is to say, and you know, we can talk about what those skills would be in the context of free software, but they would certainly involve some level of programming. These broader forms of inequality are going to continue in terms of contribution and empowerment. All right. The fifth and final reason why I think that we've struggled to address empowerment while succeeding in terms of action has to do with project life cycles. Here is a graph that shows the number of people who are members of the Debian private email list. This is not exactly the number of Debian developers or people that are sort of empowered members of the project over time, but it does capture, but it correlates very strongly to this. What you can see, of course, is that like many projects, Debian had some kind of, you know, exponential growth for a period of time, lots and lots of people joining the project, and then for a lot of reasons, that growth slowed down. I mean, actually, during a period of time, Debian developers felt that they were growing too fast and just cut off like new contributor, like joining altogether. And these sorts of life cycles are very common. You see growth of projects up to a certain point, and then you often see that they change in the sense that the projects sort of solidify over time. There's a group of people who are able to work together. We have sets of norms that we know. There are things like groups that I've shown in some of my other research that lots of free software and free culture projects actually become oligarchic in the sense that there's a small group of people present at the beginning whose interests begin to diverge from those of many of the membership. I've shown this in wikis, but there's reason to believe that this exists in free software projects as well. Getting a patch in can be harder. And some of these are good, sometimes for good reasons. The project has become more stable. The project has become more widely used. It's more important that we maintain sort of stability in the project. And some of these are less good in the sense that people want to sort of preserve their own power. But in either cases, we have projects that there are life cycles that mean that it becomes more difficult to contribute to projects as they grow older and larger and more established. And to the extent that free software has grown in this way, this may mean that it is harder along many dimensions to contribute to many particular free software projects and maybe to establish free software projects in general than it was at some period in the past. All right. So that sort of leaves us with the sort of final question of what is it that we should do about that? And I have four answers. The first thing we could do is nothing, of course. And you can probably guess that that's not the position I'm going to argue for. And if you guessed that, you would be right. But I think it's not so obviously wrong that it's not worth addressing. Because I realize, like, I really do, that empowerment, it doesn't mean that everyone has to become a programmer, right? And if you really believe that not everyone, one answer is, well, not everyone needs to be a programmer, why should we care about engagement in this sense? Why should we care about empowerment, right? If everyone has it, and all the people the vast majority of people that have this stuff don't want to, you know, they don't want to be empowered in the way that you're talking about, why do you want to go out and force them, right? Because after all, right, freedom of the press, right, is another freedom that many people believe in. It doesn't mean that we all need to go start newspapers, right? And if we say that not everyone's running a newspaper, that like that doesn't mean that the place is not free. The GNU Manifesto frequently suggests that even if you can't program, you might be able to hire someone to program for you, and I think that that's absolutely right. The important thing, after all, is not that everyone needs to be hacking on free software, but that everyone has the freedom to do it, right? It's the freedom to do it as opposed to the realization of that. That said, I think it's hard to believe that you lived in a country with a free press if there were no independent newspapers, or very, very few, or only certain kinds of people, let's say sort of rich people, male people, people in the developed world who ran newspapers. It would be hard to believe that that was free as well. And I think that, but I sort of think of, I sort of think of empowerment in this sense, or about learning, or about programming, as kind of in terms of writing or literacy, right? Many many users of free software, because many users of free software have never considered changing their pieces of their software to do something different. Now, so in terms of the comparison with literacy is sort of like this. Although it's important that imagine a world in which everyone knew how to read, but only a very small number of people knew how to write. That seems like that would be a sort of less than ideal world, that it wouldn't be democratic in some sense, right? But that kind of, to the extent that we think that software or technology is an important kind of literacy, that is kind of the world that we live in now, right? So, but that said, the end result is not a world in which everyone is a professional programmer any more than we teach everyone to write because we think that it's important that everyone become a journalist or a novelist, right? The important part is that process be demystified enough that people feel that writing is something that they could do. It's important, and so for the reasons that I think it's important to teach people to read and write, I think it's important to teach people who use software to at least understand how they would transcend their roles as consumers. The reality is that learning to program really is empowering. Being able to change how your world works yourself is empowering. That empowerment is the promise of free software and that we should not be willing to treat it only as a potential freedom. All right. Now, the second sense in which I think we can address this gap, the gap between our success in terms of access and our success in terms of empowerment, is by compromising, right? Sometimes we may simply have to choose. We may have to sacrifice efficiency in various ways by, for example, dealing with newcomers. I sometimes joke that like GNU Linux is the least efficient operating system ever sort of imagined. We have to spend like all of this time arguing with these people who are obviously wrong, right? I think the people who disagree with me are obviously wrong, right? And that we have to go through this process of of negotiation, which is not as easy as it could be, right? And that by sort of facilitating engagement of lots of new users, it means that we have to spend time dealing with sort of challenges or convincing people of things that we wouldn't have to do if we were to not be as open encourage people to be as empowered in the sense of engaging in our projects. That may in various ways mean that we should compromise quality, for example, in order to promote engagement. There are tough choices that we will have to make if we want to make empowerment of users a first order goal on the same level of access. And the figuring out how to negotiate that is something which is tricky, but it's something that I think we need to be willing to make. Compromise, I think we should be willing to make. The third thing we can do is remove systematic barriers to participation. We can work in various ways. We can work to make our projects systematically more accessible to newcomers, and we can reject unacceptable trade-offs between access and empowerment if they're in various ways. So, for example, lots of organizations have adopted codes of conduct explicitly designed to make their projects more welcoming to large numbers of people, including people who were not participating before. Lots of conferences and organizations have adopted anti-harassment policies, which systematically are trying to make it clear that systematic barriers to participation that have existed in the past should be removed to allow more people to engage. There are also lots of ways in which we have promoted outreach more broadly. So if people are familiar with Outreachy, which is a nonprofit which essentially funds people to participate in free and open source software development from groups of people. Historically, this was originally the outreach program for women, promoted women's engagement as developers and contributors in the GNOME project and now in a variety of different free software projects. There are a series of ways, and because, of course, economic inequality is one way in which lots of people are prevented from engaging. There's a sense in which I grew up very privileged. I had a computer at home. I was able to, I never took a computer science class. For me, software development was something that I engaged in recreationally because I didn't have to have, for example, a job after school and high school. I had space to explore this and ways in which to engage. And existing, and there are now a series of projects which are in various ways making it possible for people who have historically not been able to contribute to free software for lots of systematic and economic reasons to be able to do so. And Outreachy is one example of a project which is doing that very effectively. All right. The fourth and what I think is probably the single most important thing we can do to address this gap between access and empowerment is basically around education and technology education. And there's a whole bunch of ways in which this happens. I have, over the last 2 years, been running a series of projects called the Community Data Science Workshops, a series of efforts to basically teach absolute newcomers with no background at all how to program in Python, how to pull data sets from web APIs, how to ask and answer questions that they have about online communities that they are participating in, free culture and free software communities in particular, but really anything more broadly. We have taught 250 people how to program using a curriculum which is available online. You can check it out on the Community Data Science Workshops, and have explicitly decided not just to teach people to engage to have software which they can use, but really to sort of take advantage of that software and change it in various ways. If you make it a goal to give people the tools, right? We've been oversubscribed by a factor of almost 100% every time that we've tried to do this. We're now teaching 100 people at a time, twice a year. The curriculum has been picked up and people are teaching similar sort of learning Python and programming workshops more broadly in various places. OpenHatch is another project which is very active in this in a way that I think is actually really smart. OpenHatch has a series of events which they are running and which you can run. The curriculum is online, which are designed to teach people who are already users of free and open source software how to contribute. They, for example, teach people how to use Git. They teach them about the social processes in projects. They teach people about submitting patches or engaging in mailing lists. This is the hack on free software party, right? That should come after our install free software party, but that historically we have really not usually gotten to. I think that the most important thing to realize is that although those are a series of ideas of things that we can do, but I think the important thing to realize is that if we take this really seriously, if we make engagement with, you know, sort of promoting empowerment a first order goal in the same way that we have made using free software or access to free software a first order goal in the past, we can do much better. When I first was talking about the idea for this talk to Walter Bender, who's very involved with Sugar Labs, which is a project connected to the One Laptop Per Child project, sort of comes from that, and it's an interface for kids to use a free software tool to use as their sort of operating system. He sort of, had a very inspiring sort of approach to this. This is a program called TurtleArt. It's one of these block-based languages, a lot like Scratch, where kids can use to make their own programs, which itself is kind of cool because now we have a piece of educational software that is not just software that you can use to use your computer, but you can actually use to program it. But the coolest thing about it is that this lives up to an old OLPC goal, which is that for every in this program, there's a view source button. It's right up in the corner, and if you press on it, you will see the source code to the program that you are actually running. So not only can you write your own programs here, but you can actually press the view source button and you can see the Python code that implements this TurtleArt, and you can change that code to make it work in a different way, right? They have, at least in the context of TurtleArt and to some extent in Sugar more broadly, made engagement and empowerment something which is a first order goal. That it's not enough that every, it's not just that everyone will have access to the source code and can change it. There is a button right in that interface which allows you to see and to begin changing the software that you are using. But of course, the inspiring part is not just that this exists, but that people are taking advantage of it. Walter told me that during the last release of Sugar, a majority of the patches that went into Sugar, actually came from kids. Kids, many of them in Uruguay, where the largest number of users are, who are using this software and who are changing this software to fix bugs to make it work in different ways. That if we do this, if we start and design our stuff with the goal of empowerment that is as important and central in our actions and our principles as important in our actions as it is in our principles, we can make real progress. And it falls on us, right? People like us in this room, the advocates of free software, to address this. Run and contribute to and influence, you know, many of the most successful and influential free software projects. And what's at stake here is more than our particular projects, but the broader movement. Because when people realize that they can change their technological world, and when they are willing and able to do it, they are able to take control of their experience in a way that is profoundly powerful. The potential is there and can be realized in ways that I've suggested, and there are lots of other ways that I haven't, if we try. Your work here is very important, and thanks for letting me be a small part of it. Cool. So, I mean, yeah, there's time for a question or two. Yeah, sure. I'll repeat the question. All right, so the question is about sort of like how much should one have to learn to be empowered, right? Is it, you know, in terms of system programming or simple scripting, something like this? I think for me, so the analogy that I keep coming back to is this idea of writing versus programming, right? We don't insist that, like, I don't think it would be reasonable to insist that everyone should be a professional journalist or writer, nor do I think that it's important that everyone be able to, you know, be a system programmer or be able to design the chips that run in their computers. I think that the question is, at which point the goal should be to demystify programming and to put people in a position where they believe that they understand how they could change their computer to make it work more difficult in various ways. In my own work, I like teaching Python, in part because I think that it's very easy to show that you could use Python to do anything from building, like, working graphical applications to, I can point to real websites that people use all the time, you know, Instagram written in Python, that kind of thing. And people can begin to feel like they're changing things right at first. So, I don't know. I think it's an open question, and I think it's something that we'll sort of figure out. But that's how I've sort of engaged with it myself. Yeah. 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 So the question is, should empowerment also involve documentation? And I think the answer is absolutely yes. I think I'm also very active in the Wikimedia community and Wikipedia, and I see work in that space as basically falling short in exactly the same way. I have I can give the version of this talk which is like informed but unempowered, which is exactly about, Wikimedia, and which comes down to issues of documentation. I think that insofar as the documentation is an important part of the way in which we experience the software or experience the world or understand the software in the world, that sort of the ability to engage in that also becomes important. There are lots of ways to become engaged and lots of ways to sort of transcend one's roles as just a consumer of software or information goods, and I think the documentation is one way to do that. So I think that's a great point. Yeah. I'm not going to try to repeat that whole thing, but the point was that encouraging, that designing systems and encouraging people to be willing to take risks is a type of compromise that we should be willing to make in order to promote engagement with and empowerment in terms of software, free software more broadly, and other things as well. So that's a great point. I just want to take, I want to be aware that people are moving in, so maybe we'll is that okay? If we, okay, great. All right. So we'll switch over to the next speaker, but I will talk to you right now.